Welcome back to Voice of the Cape, Drive Time. Our book review today is written by Dr. Anne Bicard, and it's called Saving a Stranger's Life, The Diary of an Emergency Room Doctor. It's brought to us by Jacana Press, and it talks about the life and times of a doctor working in what we would call the emergency room. I think they used to call it trauma, through the first pandemic, the first wave of the coronavirus. But to find out what's inside the pages and who made the pages tick, Dr. Anne Bicard, who has been in the medical profession, I'm not going to give too much away, but for more than 30 years, Dr. Anne Bicard, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me.
Now, first off the bat, what inspired you to write the diary of an emergency room doctor? It's not often that we see medical doctors sitting down and, in essence, pouring their hearts out on the printed page.
I think I've always had a lot of stories to tell about working in the ED. You see some very strange things. And people have often said to me, you should write a book. And last year, I had a little bit of space, and I started writing, and then COVID came along, and I just felt we had to record what it was like in those early months, early days, and how it went for us all through the pandemic.
Indeed. And I'm going to read just a little bit of your preface, because it is a tribute to everybody working in the medical profession today, and I wouldn't have to convince you how tough it is. You say, we are masked and gloved warriors all over the world, facing the flood of sick patients daily and keeping up a professional service despite a real and present danger. I'm sure you'd agree that even before COVID, working in the emergency room of a South African hospital was already, I'm sure, a challenge.
Indeed. You know, we all went into medicine knowing that there could have been some negative outcomes for us. There have always been the possibility of catching germs or infections from people. And certainly in South Africa, the trauma room is a wild place to work. But I think we saw what was coming with COVID. We saw what was happening in other countries and what was coming our way, which made it in a way all the more frightening, because we knew it was coming. We just didn't know when exactly, and we also didn't know how bad it was going to be. So that was very anxious times for all of us, I think. The nurses, the doctors, the admin staff, everybody who worked in the hospital.
And of course, COVID has proved to be a very tricky being, hasn't it? Because you mentioned in your book that at one stage you guys were thinking that there was perhaps a different kind of a strain in the Western Cape than what there was in Gauteng. Anecdotally, as journalists, I mean, we've been at the cutting edge of it, but not inside the hospitals. But we also presented with such a diversity of what's happened to people that it becomes quite bewildering.
It is. I mean, I said right at the beginning, we know we're all going to get exposed to it. And in a way, you might as well just hurry up and get it over with. But, you know, it's not that simple. The first death that we had, I think the patient was 23 or 24 years old with absolutely no reason to die from it. So it's not as simple as you'll only get sick if you're old or frail or have a comorbidity. You know, it doesn't follow any of the rules. And some of the people that get really sick, we still don't really know why it follows such a terrible path in some people and not in others.
Yeah, I mean, but before we go to other matters in the book, it's been quite astounding to us. In fact, one of our staff members, very young, 24 years of age, died twice or flatlined twice on the table or whatever they call it. Fortunately, that person is now in recovery, healthy, nearly died. And yet you get people of like 90 years of age walking out of hospitals.
Yeah, it doesn't. The clinical COVID pneumonia shows a very typical pattern once it starts. And right at the beginning, we were all very confused by it. After a couple of months, I think everybody who works in the front line of COVID knows what the COVID pneumonia looks like, knows what the blood tests are going to look like. But why some people go down that road and others don't, you know, literally have no symptoms or have just a sore throat, we really can't explain. You know, it might be that the person's different. It might be that the strain of virus they got is worse. You know, we don't have the answers to that yet.
No, absolutely. But to get into the heart of the book, I mean, Yes, it is a tough life. It's a demanding life, but so many interesting characters, and at times some very funny incidences where you were talking to, I think, a Ghanaian intern, and you were getting very confused about rabies, and only afterwards do you discover you get confused about rabies to discover she's talking about babies.
Yes, that was a very funny moment because she said, "Oh, do you have a lot of rabies?" You know, and I said, "Not really. I mean, we do see rabies in Joburg, but not a lot. Do you have a lot of it in Ghana?" And she said, "Oh, yes, a whole ward full of people." I was amazed. I said, "You've got a whole ward just for rabies?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "But why don't you vaccinate?" And she said, "Well, because people don't want to be vaccinated." I said, "But that's ridiculous. The government must enforce it. They must make people take the vaccination." And then she looked at me as if I was some kind of dictator. And I realized that she was talking about a whole ward just for babies, not for rabies.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a moment.
I think her expression must have been priceless. That's all I can say. I can just imagine it.
Yes, she was actually great fun to work with and quite an experienced doctor, but had to redo her exam. And so she was sort of seconded to me for a whole 2 years, which probably felt like forever for her.
Shame.
To literally have to rewrite everything in order to practice in South Africa.
You know, there's a phrase of yours that jumps off the pages. Hopefully I'm not taking it out of context, but you say it's like working in the shadow of a nuclear blast. Very descriptive.
Well, I think the first wave of COVID, we were all waiting for it to happen. And I think there was this kind of a sense of the apocalypse, you know, that the roads were deserted. Everybody was on lockdown. You know, we were all anticipating being stopped on the way to work. We had our little pieces of paper with our permits and our IDs to make sure we could get to work. And there was actually no one. There was not a soul on the streets. It was crazy. And there was nothing happening in the ED for two or three months. People just did not come to the hospital, I think because they were scared of getting sick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this kind of sense of like a vacuum, like where is everyone gone? Where are all the people who have heart attacks and strokes and asthma attacks and are giving birth to babies? Surely those people are still having those things. So why aren't they coming to the hospital, you know?
Yeah, it really was totally surreal. I mean, I can remember driving down the freeway and seeing squirrels playing in the middle of the road, which is something you're not going to see in the freeway very often.
No, it is crazy. And I think people were genuinely afraid to go anywhere, you know.
If we look at some of the fascinating stories, you're quite clever. Obviously, you don't name the patients and some of your colleagues, but you give them some interesting names. And, of course, you give the specter of death. And let's face it, in the medical profession, that's what you sometimes have to deal with it. But you call death grim,
yes.
Which is interesting. Yeah, you always, every day, you have to beat grim.
Yes, grim is always around the corner. And it's nice to get one on the board against him every now and again. I don't know why I think he's a he. I suppose Grimm could be a woman as well, or a female energy. But you definitely have an occasional tussle with him. And, of course, he always wins an end. But it's nice to get the occasional point on the board and snatch one back, so to speak.
Now, I believe that you've got psychiatry in your bow, and it seems to have had to help you on a number of occasions. For example, when you get a pregnant teenager coming into the wards with a very, very hen-like mother, and somebody you call the passenger lady.
Yes. So, I didn't do psychiatry. I did psychology before I did medicine.
Right, psychology.
I actually decided not to do psychiatry for a specific reason that I didn't want to stay in psychology. But it is sometimes a bit of a game of trickery, you know, with especially because the law in South Africa is clear that it says woman of childbearing age, which can literally be 10, does not have to have an escort or any consent from any body to get tested or you know, managed in terms of pregnancy. But of course, when you've got a real live mother in the room and refuses to leave, it becomes very tricky to try and squeeze the right answers out of the daughter without her feeling exposed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to resort to trying to trick the mother out of the room so you can be alone with the daughter.
No, absolutely. And of course, you also deal with a guy called the collar guy, who seems to be having about five parallel hallucinations all at the same time.
Yes, he was an absolute classic. I thought he'd hurt his neck. And I said, Shane, have you hurt your neck? And he said, no, I wear this collar to stop myself strangling myself, which was bizarre. But yes, he was a very strange man. He had an energy that I can still remember, like an agitated energy where you actually almost didn't feel safe in the room with him. You know, he would sort of keep leaping off the bed and pacing around, snatching the door open and looking out underneath the furniture to see who was watching him.
Yeah, it seems like he must have had some kind of a drug problem. And you do indicate in your book that sometimes you have to deal with these cases. It must be difficult.
It is. You know, I found sort of over the years that it's much easier to just take a direct approach and say, do you take any, what I would use as the phrase, recreational substances or recreational drugs? Because if you don't ask the question, people are seldom going to admit it. And often that's the answer. You know, you need to get that part of the history. And quite often, you know, people are quite forthcoming about that. Maybe not in front of their family or certainly their parents. But when you get them on their own, I think most people will tell you what you need to know because they know you're only asking because you need to know the answer to that question. And I mean, unfortunately, it's much more common. When I qualified, there was almost no recreational substance abuse going on. I mean, I'm sure it was there, but we didn't really see much of it. But now we see a lot of it in ED.
Then you have some very interesting people, I'll put it that way. This man comes in, he's not in good physical condition before whatever trauma he's experienced, and his wife is scolding him while he's having a heart attack. And at the end of it all, she still asks you a rather stupid question. How do you deal with people like that? I mean, this woman didn't seem to understand that her husband was knocking on death's door.
No, well, I suppose there's always the power of denial. You know, the power of and that lady sort of said to me in a stage whisper, don't tell him he's having a heart attack. Tell him it's just reflux. And I said, well, I can't do that. I mean, he needs to know what's going on and he needs to sign consent. And anyway, I've already explained everything to him and to her. But she almost, you know, if I would just go along with it, you know, he's going to be okay, isn't he, doctor? You know, and that's a very difficult phrase that people ask because sometimes people aren't going to be okay. You know, quite often people will say, well, am I going to die? And my answer to that is, well, most certainly sometime, but not from this, you know, mm-hmm. or not on my shift, you know. But sometimes even when you lay it down and say, look, this is very serious, his condition is critical, people just don't want to hear that. But I think that particular lady just didn't get it. I think she was just so self-involved that she was worried about her hair and, you know, that she was being inconvenienced going to the shop, basically. And the guy actually knew exactly what was going on. You know, he said to me, I think I'm having a heart attack when he arrived. And I was like, I think you're right.
And of course you have bizarre scenarios sometimes when people do pass on and you have to break the news. And in this particular case, you broke the news and the person came back to life again.
Yes, that was a very funny resuscitation where the lady literally didn't respond. And so we called the resuscitation because she was a much older woman, very poor quality of life, and we decided this was not the way to go. And then when we washed up and left the bedside, she literally got a pulse and the blood pressure again. And then we had the great dilemma that we'd already informed her family that she'd passed on, and now must we phone them back and say it's a miracle. She's actually not dead. And, of course, the debate, because she was so sick and she'd had a prolonged period of cardiac arrest, chances are she was going to pass on anyway in the next few hours. But we still had to tell the family, you can't just leave something like that, you know. And then they arrived there, you know, in the mind to be speaking to the undertakers. And you say, well, sorry, actually, there's been a mistake. And your granny is actually not dead after all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to phone her back. And the physician said to me, I said, sure, we did a good resus. So he said, no, you did such a bad resus that you only revived and you left her alone.
Then there's another scenario. I think every hospital, every doctor deals with it. People coming in, demanding attention, telling you that they're sick. And, of course, they've consulted with Dr. Google or Dr. Yahoo. and you as a medical practitioner have to deal with this kind of thing.
Yeah, that can be a bit frustrating, but quite often I learn quite interesting things when people tell you, but I looked it up on Google. I'll look it up on Google then and see what it says, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem with Google is that it'll always tell you the worst case scenario. So if you just have a headache, you've already got a brain tumor, you know. So the patient comes in with the expectation that that will be the problem, whereas 99.9% of headaches are not that. And that's what Google doesn't do, is give you the sort of probability of what it could be and why, as a medical doctor, you'd be worried or not worried about something that people think is a life-threatening emergency. So quite often people will say that this is an emergency, and you have to not use your out loud voice and say, no, it's actually not. It's the people who keep quiet and are not breathing well and are not making any noise. Those are the ones that really are emergencies.
No, absolutely. And then a situation which you've had to deal with, people who pretend to be something that they're not, and they get very deep into it, and they get into trouble. Like, you had a doctor working with you called Francois, you mention him, who turned out not to be a doctor, and you also dealt with a very successful lawyer who had no qualifications.
Indeed, and it is rather a moment where, certainly if you work with a doctor who, I mean, obviously Francois is not his real name, but he was an absolutely charming chap, and I worked with him for quite long, and before we found out that he actually had faked all of his qualifications. And it was a real sort of slap in the face, because it felt to me like he'd taken us all for a ride.
Mm.
But to be honest, he really wasn't that bad. I mean, he was never on his own in the ED, so he always had somebody else to talk to. And I think he had a very sound medical background. He just wasn't a doctor. Whereas the person who pretended to be an advocate actually had never been to university at all, and had kind of fallen into that by just starting to try and help people with a bit of legal advice and becoming more and more involved in his deception, until eventually his whole life was a lie. And he couldn't stop then, because everybody thought he was an advocate, including his wife and his children and everybody else. So, you know, then when that got turned upside down, I mean, I actually felt quite sorry for the poor man. You know, he really was. He said to me, I know what I did was wrong, but I didn't ever mean to harm anyone. I just got deeper and deeper in it, you know?
Yeah, that's life sometimes. A moving part of the book is where you mention specialists at the heart of the pandemic, who probably never carried a stethoscope for decades, coming into the emergency room and saying, I'm here to help. People actually throwing themselves into the fray. Do you think the public sufficiently understands what medical people went through and what they are going through right now? It must be hell sometimes.
You know, I have to say that I think that certainly the patient base that we see are extremely grateful.
Mm-hmm.
They are, this whole pandemic has really made people realize that the medical profession are also human. And that the nurses also have older family members, and they don't want to bring COVID home. And that a lot of the people I knew moved into B&Bs or into their garage, or, you know, tried to even stay at the hospital if they couldn't afford to stay somewhere else, so as not to expose their elderly parents to the germ. I've found people to be amazing. You know, if I'm an attending doctor, I have to go into the room and examine the patient, but the rest of the time I actually stand at the door. And I'll say to the patient, I'm going to stand at the door because I need to minimize my exposure to this virus. You know, if we had 30 people through the ED, that's 30 times that I'm standing in the room with a person with an infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't once had a patient who's second-guessed that, or if anything, they're very conscious of trying not to make you sick, you know, and sort of saying, don't come too close, you know, I think I might have COVID or whatever. So I actually think that the general public has been amazing, and I think they have realized how difficult it's been. There have been the occasional, certainly slightly older doctors who decided they're not up for seeing sick patients, and have actually sort of recused themselves right at the outset of the pandemic and said, please don't call me, I'm not able to look after, you know, sick COVID patients. But by the same token, we've had dermatologists and rheumatologists and gastroenterologists who did not have to be there. They were not being paid to be there. They were not obliged to be there. Nobody asked them to be there. They saw that the hospital was in trouble and that we didn't have enough hands on deck, and they showed up, you know, and so much respect for that, because for me, I was in that line to start with. So I saw the wave coming and I was like, well, there's no way out of this for me. You know, I'm on the front line. I've always been on the front line. I can't in good conscience leave this now. You know, I can't leave my colleagues. I can't let my patients down. I can't let the unit that I work in down. So we just have to stand fast. But those doctors who basically were not obliged to do that, who still came in and worked in the COVID wards and said, you know, I haven't put a patient on a ventilator for 20 years, but show me how and I'll help you, you know. So much respect for that.
No, absolutely, absolutely amazing stuff indeed. Dr. Anne Bicard, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We've been talking about Dr. Anne Bicard's book, Saving a Stranger's Life, The Heartrending, Macabre, Hilarious Diary of an Emergency Room Doctor. It's produced by Jacana. And of course, it is at a bookshop near you. And one of the endorsements on the front cover says this, and I think it sums up the book quite nicely. Poignant in parts, shouting out funny in others, the stories leap from the page. A welcome reminder of sheer humanity and courage under pressure. Dr. Anne Bicard, carry on with the good work and may the book fly off the shelves.
Thank you, and thanks again for the interview. Stay safe there in the Cape.
Thank you very much.